A quick reminder before we get to today's episode, the science Kickstarter is underway. So if you aren't familiar with science, listen to this quick description of the graphic novel from writers Jason Inman and Ashley Victoria Robinson. It's a book I'm really excited about. I can't wait to get my hands on it and share it with my 7-year-old daughter. I think that Ashley and Jason are great writers, and their passion for comics is obvious, and it shows in the quality of their books. So take a quick listen and go pledge and share the Kickstarter with all your friends. Let's talk about your new Kickstarter. What's it all about?
It's called Science with an exclamation point.
So you gotta say it like that.
You gotta say it like Science.
Yeah, there you go. You gotta clip everybody's microphone when you say it.
Take care about that, everybody. Wake up.
Yeah. It stars a 14-year-old girl named Tamsin Trecru. It's more of a middle grade story, whereas Jupiter Jet was more of an all age story. So I guess that means it's a little bit edgier in the type of storytelling. But she is attending the Prometheus Institute. And it's the most amazing kind of school that has cute little robots called stats that fly around. It's got experimental physics. It's got amazing labs. But Tamsin's maybe not as happy to be there as she should be. And that's because her dead father used to be the headmaster there, and working there is what took him from her. So she's determined to, take the school down from the inside, like a normal teenager would want to do.
It's Harry Potter if Harry Potter wanted to destroy Hogwarts. There you go.
Tamsin is driven not only by, the trauma that comes along with losing a parent, but her father was a real smart science guy and downloaded his consciousness into her super cool glasses. So she actually sees a projection of him, and he can see everything that she's doing. And he's leading her on this quest, but he can also see like her interactions with her cute roommate, Garen, which is not what you want your dad to see when you're 14.
And the thing is, too, is that her father actually died when she was 3. So she never knew her father. The only father she has known is this holographic version of her father that has sort of existed around her. Science is a story that we think is pretty unique. I don't think there is a sort of teenager-y Star Trek science fiction-y with real facts out there. And if you like Jupiter Jet and you like our podcast, you like any of our tone, then I guarantee you're going to like this. You're going to like our flavor. And you hear about our passion for comics. Everything we do is how much we love comic books, and we inject that into our comics. Like, I think when you read our comics, especially Jupiter Jet and our stuff in the If anthologies and Love is Love, you can feel that love pouring through, and Science is the exact same thing. So if that doesn't convince you to buy Science or help us pre-order or make this book, then I don't know what will.
All right. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, I highly encourage you to go and check out the Kickstarter for Science. The good news is that in less than 36 hours, the Kickstarter was fully funded. So what that means for you, as someone who goes and does a pledge, you are guaranteed to get the book, right? Like, a lot of times you see something, a Kickstarter, you're excited, you pledge, and it doesn't get fully funded. And you're not out any cash, but you wanted the book. That's why you pledged in the first place. So you don't have to worry about that with Science. It's fully funded, and now we're on to stretch goals, right? And if you listen to our previous Spotlight episode on Science, you'll know that Jason and Ashley, the first thing they're going to do with any stretch goals they meet is add more content, more pages, more story. So again, I think it's completely worthwhile. I've already pledged. Go over there, do yourself a favor, and check it out. Welcome to episode 516 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about the first issue of Patience, Conviction, Revenge from writer and co-creator Patrick Kindlin, co-creator and artist Marco Ferrari, colorist Patrizia Camino, and letterer Jim Campbell. It's Aftershock. I'm always going to try out the first issue of any of their new series, and this one sounded pretty out there. I read it. It was great, so I thought I'd spotlight it. kind of the elevator pitch, I think, is somebody who used to be on the ends of the Las Vegas crime syndicate, a boy genius, so to speak, great with technology, and somehow he fell out, exiled out to the desert, the outskirts of Las Vegas, and he's been plotting and planning for years, and now the hour is finally at hand, and he's about to have his revenge. So this isn't your dad's Las Vegas. This isn't the family tourist attraction, gambling, flashy lights on the strip. This is much more of a post-apocalyptic Vegas. Perhaps the Vegas that might have been had the mafia and the other crime families been able to hold on to it throughout the years. Not to say that there aren't still influences there. There probably are. But this is definitely a different view of Vegas. We haven't seen a lot of it yet. We got a little bit of in flashback, and then we saw a little in the last few pages of this first issue. But what the first issue mostly does is introduce us to our protagonist, Rennie, and gives us an idea of just how smart the guy is and what his motivations are for wanting to have revenge. I mean, the fact that he named his plan Patience, Conviction, Revenge, it kind of says a lot right there. He's been out in the desert for a long time. So that's the patience, right? He's been working toward this plan for a long time, and nothing will shake his conviction and his desire for this revenge, which is the third word in the title there. So kind of an interesting title for a book, Patience, Conviction, Revenge. All three end with exclamation points. So it's Patience, Conviction, Revenge. And the art by Marco Ferrari is excellent. Very detailed. A lot of robots, a lot of desolate wasteland. Things you would think of as kind of disparate elements, right? You don't think of the Las Vegas desert, this desolation, this flatland, sand and sun and heat, to really be a place for tons and tons of technology. It makes you wonder where Rennie got the parts to create these machines that are programmed with his plan, his patience, conviction, revenge, because that is the programming that the robots have. That is his plan to go back and have his revenge on those that forced him out and ultimately take their place, I think. So the story starts off and Rennie's talking about it's got to be a story worth telling. It says, you know, everybody has a story, whether it's some guy telling you about his ex-wife, his failed pool cleaning business, his ingrown toenail. Everybody's got a story, but it's not always gripping content. And you go to a movie and it's dumbed down to the lowest common denominator. It's sanitized, and the raw human experience has been taken out of it because you don't want to offend anyone. So it's almost like a political statement about how people are so quick to be angered these days. Everybody walks around with a chip on their shoulder. And Rennie himself says, "How am I, a man of great passion, supposed to watch the cardboard version of life?" And he says, "I'm not asking for the world here. A story's what? A character plus some stuff that happens. The bar's low, right? And you don't even have to tell me the truth when you're telling me a story. Make it up. I'm not the story police. Lie to me. As long as you make it interesting. And my story may be riddled with half-truths, and it may not be fair for you to judge me. Others may call me on it and say I'm lying, but at least my story is worth telling." And then we see a robotic voice say, "How many times exactly? Like, how many times have you told me this story, Rennie?" And it's his robot, Paul, who seems to be his closest companion. And he's like, "Oh, am I boring you? Maybe I shouldn't have given you so much self-awareness. You know, some guys make their robots fully automated. There's no back and forth. All there is a yes master. But not for nothing, you know, if my boring stories are so inane to you, you know, this is actually, they're actually the story of your creation, right? If all those events wouldn't have happened to me along my life, you wouldn't even be here. You should be genuflecting or praying to me or something." And Paul the robot says, well, I'm not really religious, Rennie. He's like, don't, you're missing the subject. You're missing the point, right? But forget about all that, because the good news is that finally my time-wasting, boring-ass story is about to get some additional content. And Paul's response to that is, Operation Patience Conviction Revenge is ready to launch. And Rennie says, we're already in stage one, my man. Pack your stuff. So they start packing up. They get ready to leave. And Rennie looks like he's going to ride some kind of a motorcycle contraption. Flying motorcycle contraption even, because I don't really see, or maybe it walks on a couple of legs, because it certainly doesn't have any wheels. And Rennie's like, you got all your stuff? And Paul the robot's like, I'm a robot. I don't really have any stuff. And Rennie says, and you're going to walk the 40 miles? And Paul says, well, a robot riding a robot just feels wrong, so let's get the show on the road. So Rennie gives the order, and his army of robots come marching out. And I love this series of lines that Rennie has here. He tells his assembled army, I've been disrespected, disregarded, deposed, and disposed, but I am not yet deceased. So great alliteration there from Kindlin. And he says, as long as I've got stale workshop air in my lungs, the name of my usurpers on my lips, I'm a threat. So look, you can look at me as the light. Stuff doesn't grow without me. That's my intellect. That's my will. And really it is. I mean, he's sitting here, he's talking to these robots, these beings, these mechanical beings that only exist because of him, because of his intellect, because of his desire for revenge and his will to make that happen, his conviction, if you will, and his patience to build this army over time to get his revenge. He goes on to say that the people that are going to face his wrath are veal calves, soft men in gilded cages, toothless, feckless grubs, and we're going to make them. We're going to make a point to show the invertebrates what honor is. And so another great line here from Kindlin. Paul asks Remy, so that's our purpose, we ride for honor? And Remy says, save that for the title of your metal album, Robot Paul. We don't ride for honor, we ride for spite. And it's clear that that's what this is all about, right? Remy was forced out. He doesn't accept it. He'll have his revenge. And for all we know, he may have been forced out righteously, right? He may have gotten what he deserved and gotten what's coming to him. He doesn't seem to necessarily be that self-aware, but he does seem to be very self-involved. And it's all about him. And sometimes those make the most compelling characters, especially when they're surrounded by robots who don't have emotions. And Rennie, we can see Rennie play off those robots. They're his creations. He's their god in a way. So they start riding across the desert. They're intercepted by a group of survivalists, I guess you'd say. They call themselves the Free People of the Mojave, and their leader is Brell. And to Robot Paul's consternation, he constantly pronounces it Mojave. And it's a running gag that Kindlin plays throughout the rest of the book, which is really quite hilarious. He latches onto this Mojave joke and he does not let it go. And it ends up being, it starts off funny and then gets a little like, really, you're still calling this out? And then it because he just won't let it go, it kind of elevates it. It's actually pretty funny. So Brell and his followers invite Rennie to come and dine with them. And Rennie's like, you know, I'm on a schedule. I don't really want to go. But Brell tells him, honor binds you to the offer, you must come. So he follows Brell back to the cave of the Free People of the Mojave. They talk about their histories, where they've come from. And Brell basically says that he left the cage of the corporate world and civilization. And now he lives a simple life. And the motto of the Free People of the Mojave is, they simply live to live simply. And mostly their existence is within the beautiful struggle for sustenance. So Rennie, you could tell he's not really enamored with this. He's like, well, this kind of sounds like communism or whatever. I've got things to do. You know, I agreed to come here, but you know, can we get this show on the road? Because you sound like a boss trying to sell longer work days to the employees, and you know, sharing everything, sharing partners, collectivized termite farms, you know, the whole shebang. And Brel says, that's funny. I was a boss once, a revolting word for a disgusting position, all for the sake of hierarchy and the sake of money. But, you know, I've given all that up. So, and then Brill says, but to answer your question, yes, we do share everything. The mighty Mojave demands it. Nothing survives here without cooperation. The harsh conditions beat the selfishness out of a man. And then they're served some basically grubs and nasty looking kind of food. And Rennie's like, all right. Thanks for sharing, you know, I guess. And then Brel asks to tell Rennie, tell your story. You'll honor us by telling us more about yourself. And he kind of demurs. He says, well, there's not much to tell. I'm just another desert hermit passing through. But Brel coaxes him. He says, come now. You know, there's not many desert dwellers that have a platoon of robots. You must have a story. And, he goes on to say that the oral tradition of the free people is pulled from the stories told around campfires and midday meals. And by Rennie sharing, he'd actually be contributing to the culture of the free people. And meanwhile, Robot Paul's like, oh, here we go again. You know, he's going to hear the story for the millionth time, perhaps. So Rennie's like, all right, you want my story? Here you go. I was born in the tenements. You know, it's such a cliche, poor but honest. And you know, my mother and father they worked hard for what they had. And as we're seeing this, or as we're hearing Rennie tell this, we actually get some visuals from Marco Ferrari that don't necessarily jive with the story that Rennie's telling. He's certainly kind of whitewashing it. He's kind of cleansing it. It certainly looks like his mother and father were involved in criminal enterprise. And his father tells him, when you're locked up, here's how you survive. We see that Rennie talks about working his butt off to get a taste of upward mobility when the visual that we see from Marco Ferrari is him robbing somebody. So it's clear that, again, Rennie's painting himself as the hero of his own story, as protagonists often do. And the thing that really helped Rennie elevate and get beyond just the common criminal, or maybe the more street level criminal like his mother and father were, was that he had a real aptitude for science. And so he decided to make it his career. He's able to build gadgets and robots and everything. And that allowed him to get a job, and he became a good company man. And again, we see him in a boardroom with some ne'er-do-wells talking about planting some legitimate hires that are actually owned by the syndicate into the water department. And then from there, after 3 months, they'll have access to the main pumps and they can do their dastardly deeds. Meanwhile, Rennie's like, this is why I built drones, drone strike. Like, it's Rennie's genius that allows a lot of the crime and of the syndicate to happen, and maybe even accelerate that crime to the point where he eventually gets a raise. He's made it. He's a senior executive. And the problem with that is, once you've risen all the way to the top, the corporation that is the syndicate, they look at you, they see your salary, and they realize they can go look for a young up-and-coming criminal, enterprising person that's willing to work for less, willing to work for a third of what you're being paid, because they're hungry to have what you have. And then eventually they may rise through the ranks and become too expensive, and then they're replaced, right? It's this never-ending churn, this never-ending cycle of crime. So Rennie knew that they had his replacement lined up, and there's no loyalty in that game. And Brel says, yeah, I remember that corporate culture. It's what pushed me out here to the desert, and I love it for that aspect, that it did eventually push me out here to find myself. But I feel for the poor bastards that are still in that prison, and I hate every other aspect of it. But Braille's like, but there must be more to your story, right? So you were ushered out so unceremoniously, you must have made some enemies. What was their official excuse for kicking you out? And we see a few more flashbacks where Rennie's probably messing around with some people that he shouldn't be, drugs involved, alcohol, illegal weapons. And what he, again, kind of whitewashing it, what he tells Braille is that willful misconduct was the official reason he was forced out. But really, that's just some spineless suit projecting his insecurities on me. Truth is, I was a company man through and through, a true believer. So Braille's like, well, so after that, you wandered into the Mojave, leaving the glimmering Sodom behind you. And Rennie says, yep, that's right. I've been a dusty old sand rat ever since. And Braille seems to be taken by the story. He says, well, there's a lot in your story that reminds me of myself. You know, wasted time working for the interest of others, for that faceless monolith, the modern horror. And this connection that I feel, this kinship I feel with you, makes it that much harder to do what I have to do next. And Rennie's like, hold on a second. What? I'll put my big boy pants on and keep right on rolling. Like, he's ready to move along, right? And Braille says, well, for the love of that I have of this beautiful desert, I must confess that I do resent that she forces me into the role of a trickster, a confidence man, a murderer. And as he's shaking Rennie's hand, this contraption shoots out of his sleeve, and it's almost like a handcuff of some sort, and it immobilizes Rennie, and he calls for his robots. Robots, a little help here. But Braille tells him, hey, you're not the only inventor out here in the waste. Your robots are all frozen. And now the trap's complete. You're cut off from your army. You're only left with that owl face companion next to you. And I'm going to assume he doesn't want to be shot any more than you do. And so Rennie's a little discouraged. He's like, wow, so you're just another flim-flam man using religion as your hustle, right? All that wandering talk was just hooey, smoke and mirrors. And Braille's like, no, it's all true, but I've got to provide for my clan, right? The desert is for survivors. It's survival of the fittest. And Rennie's not really feeling it, right? He's like, so you're no different than the same feather the nest and forget the rest human tapeworm found in every corporate office. You're just out for yourself. And again, Braille tells him, hey, man, we got to eat. We've got to grow our culture. We've got to expand our way of life. You know, it's the strongest wins out here. That's just the way of things. And Rennie says, well, you've got a point. Robot Paul, would you mind? And at this point, Robot Paul, with relief, says, finally, and goes on to tell Mr. Braille, it's pronounced Mojave. H, there's an H sound. And through his chest, he fires off it almost looks like a flamethrower of sorts, which basically disintegrates not only Braille, but also his son, I guess it is, his 10-year-old child that's standing there next to him. The rest of the free people of the Mojave run off, and Braille's like, wait, I want to show you how much we appreciate your hospitality, but they ignore him and they go running off. And Rennie's a little perturbed. He's like, look at you, all you robots, most advanced robots ever in the history of human design, built by a peerless genius, of course he's referring to himself, and you're all rendered helpless by actual cave people. What do you have to say for yourself? And of course, they don't really have much to say, except apparently Robot Paul is feeling a little sad, and Rennie notices it and asks him if he's all right. He says, are you and your feelings okay? Are you sad you incinerated an 11-year-old servant boy when you firebombed his evil cult daddy? And Paul's like, whatever, can we just kind of move on? And Rennie says, all right, stow your sensitive, thought-filled nonsense. We're headed to the most dog-eat-dog hellhole in the Western world. And they do head off to Vegas, even though they're 5 hours late. And it's an interesting view we see of Vegas. I think the only landmark that we would recognize would be the Luxor in the background there, that pyramid with the light shining in the sky. And we see some dialogue in these slums that seem to have many, many levels as Paul and Rennie continue the banter back and forth, talking about what their plan is, who they're there to meet. Rennie's knocking on a door on one of the levels. We see what looks to be a woman answering the door, who is upset that someone is bothering her at this late hour. And Rennie's like, really, we're doing this now? And he says, I'm looking for Loski. And the figure says, there's no Loski here, and starts to shut the door. And Rennie's like, really? We really are doing this? You're going to make me say the password? And he says, Rennie's a pile of dog crap and tampons. And we see the figure open the door laughing, saying, you sure are. Come on in. And it's actually somebody in a robot costume who seems pleased that his robot design fooled Rennie. And Rennie's like, you know, it's not exactly a convincing robot. If I confuse it with the Hobbit, both are equally likely to arouse suspicion. And the other figure, as he climbs out of the robot, says, I thought that was how poor people talk. And by the way, you're late as hell. And Rennie's like, really? Have you been in that thing all day? And the figure responds, well, I was committed to the prank. My legs have been asleep for hours. And then he welcomes Rennie home and says, you used to live nearby, right? And Rennie says, you know, I left when I was 12. I left the slums when I was 12. And you know exactly where I lived after that. It was in a penthouse two stories above you. And the other man says, yeah, I figure I remember it. Those were a lot of fun times. And, you know, they gave that spot to Will Welsh, right? And Rennie's like, great, I'll bury him under the toilet when I take it back. And the other man says, you're ready to reclaim your seat at the table? Rennie says, no tables. This time I'll opt for the throne. And what's interesting as these two start to have their exchange, as the other man climbs out of the robot, and he's, I apologize, I'm not sure what the political correct term is. Is it small person, little person? He's, you know, very short in stature, maybe suffers from some form of dwarfism or something. I'm not really sure. But what's interesting is even though these two apparently know each other, they obviously are working on some plan together so that Rennie can get his revenge. As the man climbs out of the robot, he draws a gun. And as Rennie is speaking to him, he draws a gun. And even though the two are shaking hands in the last panel, talking about Rennie reclaiming his seat at the table or perhaps opting for a throne, they've both got their guns drawn and they're both pointing them at each other. So it's clear that there's no level of trust here. So it's very interesting that they seem to be allies, but yet there's no level of trust. And I suppose in the kind of world where these men live and the circle and the company they keep, that maybe that's just par for the course, right? You trust but verify, you trust but you cover your ass, is another way to put it. So again, I found this issue to be really fun. I found Rennie to be to be very uncouth and a whole heck of a lot of fun. He's going to tell it like it is. He's not going to pull any punches. You take everything he says with a grain of salt at the same time, though, because he said it himself in that opening line when he's talking about telling his story, right? He says, I may tell lies when telling the story of my life and telling people where I come from and what I've been through, but at least my story is interesting. And we actually saw a perfect example of that when he's telling Brell while they're having their meal. He's telling him one thing, right? And he's not necessarily out and out lying when he's saying he had to work his butt off to kind of rise above his station and all that kind of thing. But he is whitewashing it. He is leaving things out. Yeah, he had to work his butt off. He had to work his butt off at robbing people, at mugging people, at doing what he had so that he could feed himself and his family. So it's true from a certain perspective, right? So again, it goes to who can you trust? Why wouldn't I have a gun pulled on this quote unquote old friend? Because who knows if they're there to double cross me or, you know, everybody's kind of out for themselves kind of thing in this post-apocalyptic Vegas world. So it's a great start. I hope that it has some aspect of kind of a heist story or a con job that's put into place. Like, how exactly is Rennie going to get himself back in? What's he going to do to these people who have betrayed him? I mean, Vegas is the perfect setting for something like that. And I love what the creators are doing here, Kindlin and Ferrari. They're taking almost a post-apocalyptic, almost a Mad Max kind of feel to the story with the slums and the that are, you know, built up just story upon story upon story, layer upon layer upon layer. But you're mixing in the idea of a confidence scheme and this guy who's been thrown out but still understands that world. So he's going to have some kind of advantage there likely. And so, I mean, a dirty Vegas, which is a bit of a juxtaposition to the kind of clean, slick Vegas we might see in something like Ocean's 11, right? So instead of that clean, slick, beautiful, shiny, brightly lit world, we can get a much dirtier, more visceral world, but it's still Vegas, right? And everything that that entails with greed and some level of crime and gambling and, you know, den of iniquity, city of sin, whatever you want to call it. But Vegas always lends itself so well to heist stories just because of the nature of what Vegas is. So looks like we're still going to get that kind of heist story or confidence game type of story, but in a much dirtier setting. But again, you've got that Mad Max vibe with the post-apocalyptic. And then you've got Rennie himself, who seems to be somewhat of a genius. And he himself is a bit of a paradox. He himself is almost a walking juxtaposition because he is so crusty, he is so uncouth, but yet he has this genius level intellect when it comes to technology. And so he's built this army of robots, but they're not like slick looking Imperial Stormtrooper like robots, right? They're all in different shapes and sizes. They've probably all got different quirky, unique abilities to go with each of their quirky, unique looks. So I can't wait to see where the story goes from here. I was really impressed. I have to admit, when I first read the solicitation, I was kind of like, meh, I don't know. Maybe this will be a misstep from Aftershock. I think for the most part, all of their books have been worth reading, but there have been some that aren't – the execution wasn't quite there for me. This was one where the big idea didn't really grab me. From when I read the solicitation, I was just like, okay, you know, it's Aftershock though, I'll check it out. But the actual story, the actual execution of this idea kind of blew me away. I don't think that the solicitation really gives you an idea of just how visceral and how compelling and how interesting the characters are right from the start in this first issue. The solicitation, they came off as a little two-dimensional, which, you know, it's really hard to convey tone and mood in a solicitation when it's just a couple of sentences, which is why you've got to be willing to give things a try. Even if it's just picking it up off the rack in your comic store and flipping through it, I think doing that with this book, you would get a sense of kind of the mood and the tone and certainly the look that the creators are going for. I think you would be pulled in. So it's a really great first issue, really great start to the series. So kudos to all the creative team that are involved, from Kindlin to the art by Ferrari, the colors by Patrizia Camino were done very, very well. And also the letters from Campbell were done extremely well. Also, there's a few times where, like, for instance, when Paul the robot says, "Patience, conviction, revenge is ready to launch," he makes those three words much larger to the point where they don't even fit in the panel. So kudos to him for that, as well as using some differently shaped dialogue boxes to denote when machines are talking rather than humans. All the creative team did a great job in this first issue. I'm really excited for issue two, and the artwork, especially by Ferrari, Marco Ferrari, a lot of detail. Really, really great first start. I can't wait to see where the story goes from here. So the first issue just came out last Wednesday, September 19th. So you should be able to still find it at your local comic shop, or ask your retailer to order you a copy if they don't have any there on the shelves. The other thing I want to mention in this episode is that coming up this Wednesday, the 26th of September, we have the Beyonders number 2 from Paul Jenkins with art from Wesley St. Clair. Got my review copy, checked it out. It answers a lot of questions that you may have had about just what the heck is going on in this title, The Beyonders. There's plenty of mystery that remains, plenty of mysteries to be solved. But I do love that within the first two issues, the premise is firmly established. So in the first issue, you know, we meet Jacob. We kind of get a sense of who he is, his fascination for mysteries and conspiracy theories and things like that. Jenkins could have taken his time and kind of doled it out in little bits and pieces who the girl was that came and got him, Noreen, basically, and taken his time with letting us understand and taking his time with letting us understand who it is that Noreen works for. And it would have been kind of a different narrative. Instead, in the second issue, Jenkins goes pedal to the metal and we learn a lot about the society, the group that Noreen works with. We learn a lot about the Order, which are kind of the Beyonders is the group that Noreen is affiliated with. And they're the good guys, for lack of a better term. And we do find out that they're kind of their opposite number is the Order, also known as the Illuminati, which a lot of us have heard that term before. So the battle lines, if you will, are clearly drawn quickly in the second issue. And we also get to see Jacob and Noreen work together to already solve some of the mysteries, to really set them on the path going forward to saving the world and discovering what's behind all these conspiracies. So it's an interesting choice that Jenkins made to kind of set tone and mood in the first issue, use the second issue to answer a lot of concrete questions, and then basically send us on a race is what it looks like from the way the second issue ends with the information that Jacob and Noreen were able to find. It looks like there are many places across the globe where these Beyonders are going to have to go to try to retrieve things. So it's a kind of a classic storytelling technique where you have two organizations, one good, one evil, and they're basically racing across the planet to collect whatever these things might be that are going to allow them to win the day if you're the good guys, or to rule the planet, or whatever your evil machinations are as kind of the evil group that's involved in this race. So really great artwork by Wesley St. Clair as well. He does a great job of keeping it mysterious, especially with a lot of the color choices that he uses. So I'm really enjoying what's been happening in this book so far. I'll also mention that there continues to be little glyphs and symbols and or numbers in just about every panel of the book, which if you can somehow decipher what they all mean, you can win like real actual cool prizes from Aftershock. And man, I'm not good at codes and things like that. I have no idea what these little symbols mean, but there's literally one in like every panel. And I'm fascinated by that for sure. So I hope when somebody does crack the code, they explain it all to us, because I'll go back through and figure out what it all means. That would be interesting to me. So anyway, that comes out this Wednesday, the 26th, as I mentioned. So I do encourage you all to go and pick that up. Also, I'll mention that on next week's Aftershock Monday, I'm going to be talking to Adam Glass about his upcoming Lollipop Kids title. And then the following week will be an interview with the creative team, at least the writer anyway, Peter Calloway, I believe is his name, from The Last Space Race, which is another upcoming Aftershock title, which has me really excited. So we'll have a couple interviews coming up for you really soon on the next couple of Aftershock Mondays. So make sure you tune in for those. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Don't forget, the next show I'll be at is New York Comic Con, coming up the first weekend of October. So if you're going to be there, let me know. I always love to meet up with listeners, and I'll hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard, and we'll talk some comics. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.